were vitamins, but not many of them. There was a machine gun in the room, the old Soviet NSV. It belonged on a tank turret. Paulie had it suspended from a chain in the middle of the room. It hung there like a macabre sculpture, like the Alexander Calder thing they put in every new airport terminal. He could stand behind it and swing it through a complete circle. He could fire it through the front window or the back window, like they were gun ports. Limited field of fire, but he could cover 40 yards of the road to the west and 40 yards of the driveway to the east. It was fed by a belt that came up out of an open ammunition case placed on the floor. There were maybe 20 more cases stacked against the wall. The cases were dull olive, all covered with Cyrillic letters and red stars. The gun was so big I had to back up against the wall to get around it. I saw two telephones. One was probably an outside line. The other was probably an internal phone that reached the house. There were alarm boxes on the wall. One would be for the sensors out in no man's land. The other would be for the motion detector on the gate itself. There was a video monitor showing a milky, monochrome picture from the gatepost camera.
"You kicked me," he said.
I said nothing.
"Then you tried to run me over."
"Warning shots," I said.
"About what?"
"Duke's gone," I said. He nodded.
"I heard."
"So it's me now. You've got the gate, I've got the house." He nodded again, said nothing. "I look after the Becks now. I'm responsible for their security. Mr. Beck trusts me. He trusts me so much he gave me a weapon." I was giving him a stare the whole time I was talking, the kind of stare that feels like pressure between the eyes. This would be the moment when the meth and the steroids should kick in and make him grin like an idiot and say, "Well, he ain't gonna trust you anymore when I tell him what I found out there on the rocks, is he? When I tell him you already had a weapon." He would shuffle and grin and use a sing-song voice. But he said nothing, did nothing, didn't react at all beyond a slight defocus in his eyes, like he was having trouble computing the implications. "Understand?" I said.
"It used to be Duke, and now it's you,"
he said mutually. It wasn't him who had found my stash. "I'm looking out for their welfare, including Mrs. Beck's. That game is over now. Okay?" He said nothing. I was getting a sore neck from looking up into his eyes. My vertebrae are much more accustomed to looking downward at people. "Okay?" I said again.
"Or?"
"Or you and I will have to go around and around."
"I'd like that."
I shook my head. "You wouldn't like it. Not one little bit. I'd take you apart, piece by piece."
"You think?"
"You ever hit an MP?" I asked. "Back in the service?" He didn't answer, just looked away and stayed quiet. He was probably remembering his arrest. He probably resisted a little and needed to be subdued. So consequently, he probably tripped down some stairs somewhere and suffered a fair amount of damage, somewhere between the scene of the crime and the holding cell, probably, purely by accident. That kind of thing happens in certain circumstances. But then the arresting officer probably sent 6 guys to pick him up. I would have sent 8. "And then I'd fire you," I said. His eyes came back, slow and lazy.
"You can't fire me. I don't work for you. Or Beck."
"So who do you work for?"
"Somebody."
"Has somebody got a name?" He shook his head.
"No dice."
I kept my hands in my pockets and eased my way around the machine gun, headed for the door. "We straight now?" I said. He looked at me, said nothing, but he was calm. His morning dosages must have been well balanced. "Mrs. Beck is off limits, right?"
"While you're here. You won't be here forever."
"I hope not," I thought. His telephone rang. The outside line, I guessed. I doubted if Elizabeth or Richard would be calling him from the house. The ring was loud in the silence. He picked it up and said his name. Then he just listened. I heard a trace of a voice in the earpiece, distant and indistinct with plastic peaks and resonances that obscured what was being said. The voice spoke for less than a minute. Then the call was over. He put the phone down and moved his hand quite delicately and used the flat of his palm to set the machine gun swinging gently on its chain. I realized it was a conscious imitation of the thing I had done with the heavy bag down in the gym on our first morning together. He grinned at me.
I'm watching you. I'll always be watching you.
I ignored him and opened the door and stepped outside. The rain hit me like a fire hose. I leaned forward and walked straight into it, held my breath, and had a very bad feeling in the small of my back until I was all the way through the 40-yard arc the back window could cover. Then I breathed out. Not Beck, not Elizabeth, not Richard, not Paulie. No dice. Dominique Cole said no dice to me the night we had our first beer. Something unexpected had come up, and I had to rain-check the first evening, and then she rain-checked my makeup date, so it was about a week before we got together, maybe 8 days. Sergeants drinking with captains was difficult on post back then, because the clubs were rigorously separate, so we went out to a bar in town. It was the usual kind of place, long and low, 8 pool tables, plenty of people, plenty of neon, plenty of jukebox noise, plenty of smoke. It was still very hot. The air conditioners were running flat out and getting nowhere. I was wearing fatigue pants and an old T-shirt because I didn't own any personal clothes. Cole arrived wearing a dress. It was a simple A-line, no sleeves, knee-length, black with little white dots on it. Very small dots, not like big polka dots or anything. A very subtle pattern. How's Frasconi working out? I asked her.
Tony? He's a nice guy.
She didn't say anything more about him. We ordered Rolling Rocks, which suited me because it was my favorite drink that summer. She had to lean very close to talk because of the noise. I enjoyed the proximity, but I wasn't fooling myself. It was the decibel level making her do it, nothing else. And I wasn't going to try anything with her. No formal reason not to. There were rules back then, I guess, but there were no regulations yet. The notion of sexual harassment was slow coming to the Army. But I was already aware of the potential unfairness. Not that there was any way I could help or hurt her career. Her jacket made it plain she was going to make Master Sergeant and then First Sergeant like night follows day. It was only a matter of time. Then came the leap up to E-9 status, Sergeant Major. That was hers for the taking, too. After that, she would have a problem. After Sergeant Major came Command Sergeant Major, and there's only one of those in each regiment. After that came Sergeant Major of the Army, and there's only one of those, period. So she would rise and then stop, whatever I said about it.
We have a tactical problem. Or strategic, maybe.
Why?
The pointy head, Garowski? We don't think it's blackmail in the sense that he's got some terrible secret or anything. Looks to us more like straightforward threats against his family. Coercion, rather than blackmail.
How can you tell?
His file is clean as a whistle. He's been background checked to hell and back. That's why they do it. They're trying to avoid the possibility of blackmail.
Was he a Red Sox fan? She shook her head.
Yankees. He's from the Bronx. Went to the High School of Science there.
Okay. I like him already.
But the book says we should bust him right now.
What's he doing?
We've seen him taking papers out of the lab.
Are they still doing the Sabo?
She nodded. But they could publish the Sabo design in Stars and Stripes, and it wouldn't tell anybody anything. So the situation isn't critical yet.
What does he do with the papers?
He dead drops them in Baltimore.
Have you seen who picks them up? She shook her head.
No dice, she said.
What are you thinking about the pointy head?
I don't want to bust him. I think we should get whoever it is off his back and leave him be. He's got 2 baby girls.
What does Frasconi think?
He agrees.
Does he? She smiled.
Well, he will. But the book says different.
Forget the book.
Really?
Direct order from me, I said. I'll put it in writing if you want. Go with your instinct. Trace the chain the whole way to the other end. If we can, we'll keep this Garowski guy out of trouble. That's my usual approach with Yankees fans. But don't let it get away from you.
I won't.
Wrap it up before they get done with the Sabo, or we'll have to think of another approach.
Okay.
Then we talked about other things and drank a couple more beers. After an hour, there was something good on the jukebox, and I asked her to dance. For the second time that night, she told me, no dice. I thought about that phrase later. Clearly, it came from crapshooter's jargon. It must have originally meant foul, like a call, like the dice hadn't been properly rolled. No dice, like a baseball umpire calling a grounder over the bag. Foul ball. Then much later, it became just another negative, like no way, no how, no chance. But how far back in its etymology was she mining? Had she meant a plain no? Or was she calling a foul? I wasn't sure. I was completely soaked when I got back to the house, so I went upstairs and took possession of Duke's room and toweled off and dressed in a fresh set of his clothes. The room was at the front of the house, more or less central. The window gave me a view west all the way along the driveway. The elevation meant I could see over the wall. I saw a Lincoln Town Car in the far distance. It was heading straight for us. It was black. It had its headlights on because of the weather. Paulie came out in his slicker and opened the gate well ahead of time so it didn't have to slow down. It came straight through, moving fast. The windshield was wet and smeared, and the wipers were beating back and forth. Paulie had been expecting it. He had been alerted by the phone call. I watched it approach until it was lost to sight below me. Then I turned away. Duke's room was square and plain, like most of the rooms in the house. It had dark paneling and a big oriental carpet. There was a television set and two telephones, external and internal, I guessed. The sheets were clean, and there were no personal items anywhere except for clothes in the closet. I guessed maybe early in the morning Beck had told the maid about the personnel change. I guessed he had told her to leave the clothes for me. I went back to the window, and about 5 minutes later I saw Beck coming back in the Cadillac. Paulie was ready for him, too. The big car barely had to slow. Paulie swung the gate shut after it, then he chained it and locked it. The gate was 100 yards from me, but I could make out what he was doing. The Cadillac disappeared from view beneath me and headed around to the garage block. I headed downstairs. I figured since Beck was back, it might be time for lunch. I figured maybe Paulie had chained the gate because he was heading on down to join us. But I was wrong. I made it to the hallway and met Beck coming out of the kitchen. His coat was spotted with rain. He was looking for me. He had a sports bag in his hand. It was the same bag he had carried the guns to Connecticut in.
"Job to do," he said. "Right now. You need to catch the tide."
"Where?" He moved away, turned his head, and called over his shoulder.
"The guy in the Lincoln will tell you."
I went through the kitchen and outside. The metal detector beeped at me. I walked back into the rain and headed for the garage block, but the Lincoln was parked right there at the corner of the house. It had been turned and backed up so its trunk faced the sea. There was a guy in the driver's seat. He was sheltering from the rain, and he was impatient. He was tapping on the wheel with his thumbs. He saw me in the mirror, and the trunk popped, and he opened his door and slid out fast. He looked like somebody had dragged him out of a trailer park and shoved him in a suit. He had a long, graying goatee hiding a weak chin. He had a greasy ponytail held together by a pink rubber band. The band was speckled with glitter. It was the kind of thing you see on drugstore carousels, placed low down so little girls will choose them. He had old acne scars. He had prison tattoos on his neck. He was tall and very thin, like a regular person split lengthwise into two.
"You're the new Duke?" he said to me.
"Yes, I'm the new Duke."
"I'm Holly."
I didn't tell him my name.
"So let's do it."
"Do what?" He came around and raised the trunk lid all the way.
"Garbage disposal," he said.
There was a military-issue body bag in the trunk, heavy black rubber zipped all along its length. I could see by the way it was folded into the space that it held a small person, a woman, probably.
"Who is it?" I asked.
although I already knew the answer.
The government bitch. Took us long enough, but we got her in the end.
He leaned in and grabbed his end of the bag, clamped both corners in his hands, waited for me. I just stood there, feeling the rain against my neck, listening to it snapping and popping against the rubber.
"Gotta catch the tide," he said. "It's going to turn."
I leaned down and took hold of the corners at my end. We glanced at each other to coordinate our efforts and heaved the bag up and out. It wasn't heavy, but it was awkward, and Harley was not strong. We carried it a few steps toward the shore. "Put it down," I said.
"Why?"
"I want to see." Harley just stood there.
I don't think you do."
"Put it down," I said again. He hesitated a second longer, and then we squatted together and laid the bag on the rocks. The body settled inside with its back arched upward. I stayed squatted down and duck-walked around to the head, found the zipper tag and pulled.
"Just look at the face," Harley said. "That part's not too bad."
I looked. It was very bad. She had died in extreme agony, that was clear. Her face was blasted with pain. It was still twisted into the shape of her final, ghastly scream. But it wasn't Teresa Daniel. It was Beck's maid. Chapter 9. I inched the zipper down a little more until I saw the same mutilation I had seen 10 years previously. Then I stopped, turned my head into the rain and closed my eyes. The water on my face felt like tears.
"Let's get on with it,"
Harley said. I opened my eyes, stared at the waves, pulled the zipper back up without looking anymore, stood slowly and stepped around to the foot of the bag. Harley waited. Then we each grabbed our corners and lifted, carried the burden over the rocks. He led me south and east, way out to a place on the shore where two granite shelves met. There was a steep, V-shaped cleft between them. It was half full of moving water.
"Wait until after the next big wave," Harley said.
It came booming in, and we both ducked our heads away from the spray. The cleft filled to the top, and the tide ran up over the rocks and almost reached our shoes. Then it pulled away again and the cleft emptied out. Gravel rattled and drained. The surface of the sea was laced with dull gray foam and pitted by the rain.
"Okay, put it down," Harley said.
He was out of breath.
"Hold your hand."
We laid the bag down so the head end was hanging out over the granite shelf and into the cleft. The zipper faced upward. The body was on its back. I held both corners at the foot. The rain plastered my hair to my head and ran into my eyes. It stung. Harley squatted and straddled the bag and humped the head end farther out into space. I went with him, inch by inch, small steps on the slippery rocks. The next wave came in and eddied under the bag. It floated it up a little. Harley used the temporary buoyancy to slide it a little farther into the sea. I moved with it. The wave receded, the cleft drained again, the bag drooped down. The rain thrashed against the stiff rubber. It battered our backs. It was deathly cold. Harley used the next 5 waves to ease the bag out more and more until it was hanging right down into the cleft. I was left holding empty rubber. Gravity had jammed the body tight up against the top of the bag. Harley waited and looked out to sea, and then ducked low and pulled the zipper all the way down, scrambled back fast and took a corner from me, held tight. The 7th wave came booming in. We were soaked with its spray. The cleft filled and the bag filled, and then the big wave receded and sucked the body right out of the bag. It floated motionless for a split second, and then the undertow caught it and took it away. It went straight down into the depths. I saw long, fair hair streaming in the water and pale skin flashing green and gray, and then it was gone. The cleft foamed red as it drained.
"Ah, hell of a riptide here," Harley said.
I said nothing.
"The undertow takes them right out. We never had one come back, anyways. Pulls them a mile or two, going down all the way. Then there's sharks out there, I guess. They cruise the coast here. Plus all kinds of other creatures, you know, crabs, suckerfish, things like that."
I said nothing. Never had one come back, he said again. I glanced at him, and he smiled at me. His mouth was like a caved-in hole above a goatee. He had rotten yellow stumps for teeth. I glanced away again. The next wave came in. It was only a small one, but when it receded, the cleft was washed clean. It was like nothing had happened, like nothing had ever been there. Harley stood up awkwardly and zipped the empty bag. Pink water sluiced out of it and ran over the rocks. He started rolling it up. I glanced back at the house. Beck was standing in the kitchen doorway, alone, watching us. We went back toward the house, soaked with rain and salt water. Beck ducked back into the kitchen. We followed him in. Harley hung around on the edge of the room, like he felt he shouldn't be there.
She was a federal agent, I said.
No question, Beck said.
His sports bag was on the table, in the center, prominent like a prosecution exhibit in a courtroom. He zipped it open and rummaged inside.
Check this out.
He lifted a bundle onto the table, something wrapped in a damp, dirty, oil-stained rag, the size of a hand towel. He unfolded it and took out Duffy's Glock 19.
This saw was hidden in the car we let her use.
The Saab? I said, because I had to say something. He nodded.
In the well where the spare tire is, under the trunk floor.
He laid the Glock on the table, took the two spare magazines out of the rag and laid them next to the gun. Then he put the bent brad awl next to them and the sharpened chisel and Angel Doll's key ring. I couldn't breathe.
The brad awl is a lockpick, I guess, Beck said.
How does this prove she was federal? He picked up the Glock again and turned it around and pointed to the right-hand side of the slide.
Serial number. We checked with Glock in Austria, by computer. We have access to that kind of thing. This particular gun was sold to the United States government about a year ago, part of a big order for the law enforcement agencies. 17s for the male agents and 19s for the women. So that's how we know she was federal.
I stared at the serial number.
Did she deny it?
He nodded.
Of course she did. She said she just found it. Gave us a big song and dance. She blamed you, actually. Said it was your stuff. But then, they always deny it, don't they? They're trained to, I guess.
I looked away, stared through the window at the sea. Why had she picked it all up? Why hadn't she just left it there? Was it some kind of a housekeeping instinct? She didn't want it to get wet, or what?
You look upset, Beck said.
And how did she even find it? Why would she even be looking?
You look upset, he said again.
I was beyond upset. She had died in agony, and I had done it to her. She probably thought she was doing me a favor by keeping my stuff dry, by keeping it from rusting. She was just a dumb, naive kid from Ireland trying to help me out, and I had killed her as surely as if I had stood there and butchered her myself. I'm responsible for security, I said. I should have suspected her.
You're responsible only since last night, so don't beat yourself up over it. You haven't even got your feet under the table yet. It was Duke who should have made her.
But I never would have suspected her, I said. I thought she was just a maid.
Hey, me too. Duke also.
I looked away again, stared at the sea. It was gray and heaving. I didn't really understand. She found it, but why would she hide it so well?
This is the clincher, Beck said.
I looked back in time to see him lifting a pair of shoes out of the bag. They were big, square, clunky items. Black, the shoes she had been wearing every single time I had seen her.
Look at this, he said.
He turned the right shoe over and pulled a pin out of the heel with his fingernails. Then he swiveled the heel rubber like a little door and turned the shoe the right way up. He shook it. A small, black, plastic rectangle clattered out on the table. It landed face down. He turned it over. It was a wireless email device, exactly identical to my own. He passed me the shoe. I took it, stared at it, blankly. It was a woman's size 6, made for a small foot. But it had a wide, bulbous toe, and therefore a wide, thick heel to balance it visually, some kind of a clumsy fashion statement. The heel had a rectangular cavity carved out of it, identical to mine. It had been done neatly. It had been done with patience, but not by a machine. It showed the same faint tool marks that mine did. I pictured some guy in a lab somewhere, a line of shoes on a bench in front of him, the smell of new leather, a small arc of wood-carving tools laid out in front of him, curls and slivers of rubber accumulating on the floor around him as he labored. Most government work is surprisingly low-tech. It's not all exploding ballpoint pens and cameras built into watches. A trip to the mall to buy a commercial email device and a pair of plain shoes is about as cutting-edge as most of it gets.
"What are you thinking?" Beck asked.
I was thinking about how I was feeling. I was on a roller coaster. She was still dead, but I hadn't killed her anymore. The government computers had killed her again. So I was relieved, personally. But I was more than a little angry, too. Like, what the hell was Duffy doing? What the hell was she playing at? It was an absolute rule of procedure that you never put two or more people undercover in the same location unless they're aware of each other. That was absolutely basic. She had told me about Teresa Daniel, so why the hell hadn't she told me about this other woman? "Unbelievable," I said.
"The battery is dead," he said.
He was holding the device in both hands, using both thumbs on it, like a video game.
"It doesn't work, anyway."
He passed it to me. I put the shoe down and took it from him, pressed the familiar power button, but the screen stayed dead. "How long was she here?"
8 weeks,
Beck said.
"It's hard for us to keep domestic staff. It's lonely here. And there's, Polly, you know. And Duke wasn't a very hospitable guy either."
"I guess 8 weeks would be a long time for a battery to last."
"What would be their procedure now?" he asked.
"I don't know. I was never federal."
"In general. You must have seen stuff like this."
I shrugged. "I guess they'd have expected it. Communications are always the first things to get screwed up. She drops off the radar, they wouldn't worry right away. They'd have no choice but to leave her in the field. I mean, they can't contact her to order her home, can they? So I guess they would trust her to get the battery charged up again, as soon as she could." I turned the unit on its edge and pointed to the little socket on the bottom. "Looks like it needs a cell phone charger, something like that."
"Would they send people after her?"
"Eventually, I guess."
"When?"
"I don't know. Not yet, anyway."
"We plan to deny she was ever here. Deny we ever saw her. There's no evidence she was ever here."
"You better clean her room real good. There'll be fingerprints and hair and DNA all over the place."
"She was recommended to us. We don't advertise in the paper or anything. Some guys we know in Boston put her in touch."
He glanced at me. I thought, some guys in Boston begging for a plea bargain, helping the government any which way they could. I nodded. "Tricky," I said. "Because what does that say about them?" He nodded back sourly. He agreed with me. He knew what I was saying. He picked up the big bunch of keys from where they were lying next to the chisel.
"I think these are angel dials," he said.
I said nothing.
"So, it's a three-way nightmare. We can tie Dahl to the Hartford crew, and we can tie our Boston friends to the feds. Now we can tie Dahl to the feds, too, because he gave his keys to the undercover bitch, which means the Hartford crew must be in bed with the feds as well. Dahl's dead, thanks to Duke, but I've still got Hartford, Boston, and the government on my back. I'm going to need you, Reacher."
I glanced at Harley. He was looking out the window at the rain. "Was it just Dahl?" I asked. Beck nodded.
"I've been through all of that. I'm satisfied. It was just Dahl. The rest are solid. They're still with me. They were very apologetic about Dahl."
"Okay," I said. There was silence for a long moment. Then Beck rewrapped my stash in its rag and dumped it back in his bag. He threw the dead email device in after it and piled the maid's shoes on top. They looked sad and empty and forlorn.
"I've learned one thing," he said. "I'm going to start searching people's shoes. That's for damn sure. You can bet your life on that."
I bet my life on it, right there and then. I kept my own shoes on. I got back up to Duke's room and checked his closet. There were 4 pairs in there. Nothing I would have picked out for myself in a store, but they looked reasonable, and they were close to the right size. But I left them there. To show up so soon in different shoes would raise a red flag. And if I was going to ditch mine, I was going to ditch them properly. No point leaving them in my room for casual inspection. I would have to get them out of the house. And there was no easy way of doing that right then. Not after the scene in the kitchen. I couldn't just walk downstairs with them in my hands. What was I supposed to say? "What? These? Oh, they're the shoes I was wearing when I arrived. I'm just going out to throw them in the ocean." Like I was suddenly bored with them? So I kept them on. And I still needed them anyway. I was tempted, but I wasn't ready to cut Duffy out. Not just yet. I locked myself in Duke's bathroom and took the email device out. It was an eerie feeling. I hit power, and the screen came up with a message. "We need to meet." I hit reply and sent, "You bet your ass we do." Then I turned the unit off and nailed it back into my heel and went down to the kitchen again.
"Go with Harley," Beck told me. "You need to bring the Saab back."
The cook wasn't there. The counters were neat and clean. They had been scrubbed. The stove was cold. It felt like there should be a closed sign hanging on the door.
"What about lunch?" I said.
"You hungry?"
I thought back to the way the sea had swelled the bag and claimed the body. Saw the hair under the water, fluid and infinitely fine. Saw the blood rinsing away, pink and diluted. I wasn't hungry.
"Starving," I said.
Beck smiled sheepishly.
"You're one cold son of a bitch, Reacher."
"I've seen dead people before. I expect to see them again." He nodded.
"The cook is off duty. Eat out, okay?"
"I don't have any money." He put his hand in his pants pocket and came out with a wad of bills, started to count them out, and then just shrugged and gave it up and handed the whole lot to me. It must have been close to $1,000.
"Walking around money," he said. "We'll do the salary thing later."
I put the cash in my pocket.
"Harley's waiting in the car."
I went outside and pulled my coat collar up. The wind was easing. The rain was reverting to vertical. The Lincoln was still there at the corner of the house. The trunk lid was closed. Harley was drumming his thumbs on the wheel. I slid into the passenger seat and buzzed it backward to get some leg room. He fired up the engine and set the wipers going and took off. We had to wait while Pauly unchained the gate. Harley fiddled with the heater and set it on high. Our clothes were wet and the windows were steaming up. Pauly was slow. Harley started drumming again.
"You two work for the same guy?" I asked him.
"Me and Pauly? Sure."
"Who is he?"
"Beck didn't tell you?"
"No."
"Well, then I won't either, I guess."
"Hard for me to do my job without information."
"That's your problem, not mine."
He gave me his yellow, gappy smile again. I figured if I hit him hard enough, my fist would take out all the little stumps and end up somewhere in the back of his scrawny throat. But I didn't hit him. Pauly got the chain loose and swung the gate back. Harley took off immediately and squeezed through with about an inch of clearance on each side. I settled back in my seat. Harley clicked the headlights on and accelerated hard, and rooster tails of spray kicked up behind us. We drove west because there was no choice for the first 12 miles. Then we turned north on Route 1, away from where Elizabeth Beck had taken me, away from Old Orchard Beach and Sawco, toward Portland. I had no view of anything because the weather was so dismal. I could barely see the taillights on the traffic ahead of us. Harley didn't speak, just rocked back and forth in the driver's seat and drummed his thumbs on the wheel and drove. He wasn't a smooth driver. He was always either on the gas or the brake. We sped up, slowed down, sped up, slowed down. It was a long 20 miles. Then the road swerved hard to the west, and I saw I-295 close by on our left. There was a narrow tongue of gray seawater beyond it, and beyond that was the Portland airport. There was a plane taking off in a huge cloud of spray. It roared low over our heads and swung south over the Atlantic. Then there was a strip mall on our left with a long, narrow parking lot out front. The mall had the sort of stores you expect to find in a low-rent place trapped between two roads near an airport. The parking lot held maybe 20 cars in a line, all of them head in and square on to the curb. The old Saab was fifth from the left. Harley pulled the Lincoln in and stopped directly behind it, drummed his thumbs on the wheel.
"Oh, yes. Keys in the door pocket."
I got out in the rain, and he drove off as soon as I shut my door. But he didn't get back on Route 1. At the end of the lot, he made a left, then an immediate right. I saw him ease the big car through an improvised exit made of lumpy, poured concrete that led into the adjoining lot. I pulled my collar up again and watched as he drove slowly through it, and then disappeared behind a set of brand-new buildings. They were long, low sheds made of bright corrugated metal, some kind of a business park. There was a network of narrow blacktop roads. They were wet and shiny with rain. They had high concrete curbs, smooth and new. I saw the Lincoln again through a gap between buildings. It was moving slow and lazy, like it was looking to park somewhere. Then it slid behind another building, and I didn't see it again. I turned around. The Saab was nose in to a discount liquor store. Next to the liquor store, on one side, was a place that sold car stereos, and on the other side was a place with a window full of fake crystal chandeliers. I doubted if the maid had been sent out to buy a new ceiling fixture, or to get a CD player installed in the Saab, so she must have been sent to the liquor store. And then she must have found a whole bunch of people waiting there for her. 4 of them, maybe 5, at least. After the first moment of surprise, she would have changed from a bewildered maid to a trained agent fighting for her life. They would have anticipated that. They would have come mob-handed. I looked up and down the sidewalk, then I looked at the liquor store. It had a window full of boxes. There was no real view out. But I went in anyway. The store was full of boxes, but empty of people. It felt like it spent most of its time that way. It was cold and dusty. The clerk behind the counter was a gray guy of about 50. Gray hair, gray shirt, gray skin. He looked like he hadn't been outside in a decade. He had nothing I wanted to buy as an icebreaker, so I just went right ahead and asked him my question. "See that Saab out there?" He made a big show of lining up his view out front.
"I see it."
"You see what happened to the driver?"
"No."
People who say no right away are usually lying. A truthful person is perfectly capable of saying no, but generally they stop and think about it first, and they add, "sorry," or something like that. Maybe they come out with some questions of their own. It's human nature. They say, "Sorry, no. Why, what happened?" I put my hand in my pocket and peeled off a bill from Beck's wad, purely by feel. Took it out. It was 100. I folded it in half and held it up between my finger and my thumb. "Now, did you see?" He glanced to his left, my right, toward the business park beyond his walls. Just a fast glance, furtive, out and back.
"Nah."
"Black town car? Drove off that way?"
"I didn't see. I was busy."
"You're practically rushed off your feet in here. I can see that. It's a miracle one man can handle the pressure."
"I was in the back, on the phone, I guess."
I kept 100 up there in my hand for another long moment. I guessed 100 tax-free dollars would represent a healthy slice of his week's net take. But he looked away from it. That told me plenty, too. "Okay," I said. I put the money back in my pocket and walked out. I drove the Saab 200 yards south on Route 1 and stopped at the first gas station I saw. Went in and bought a bottle of spring water and two candy bars. I paid four times more for the water than I would have for gasoline, if you calculated it by the gallon. Then I came out and sheltered near the door and peeled a candy bar and started eating it. Used the time to look around. No surveillance. So I stepped over to the payphones and used my change to call Duffy. I had memorized her motel number. I crouched under the plastic bubble and tried to stay dry. She answered on the second ring. "Drive north to Sawco," I said. "Right now. Meet me in the big brick mall on the River Island in a coffee shop called Café Café. Last one there buys." I finished my candy bar as I drove south. The Saab rode hard, and it was noisy compared to Beck's Cadillac or Harley's Lincoln. It was old and worn. The carpets were thin and loose. It had six figures on the clock. But it got the job done. It had decent tires, and the wipers worked. It made it through the rain okay. And it had nice, big mirrors. I watched them all the way. Nobody came after me. I got to the coffee shop first, ordered a tall espresso to wash the taste of chocolate out of my mouth. Duffy showed up 6 minutes later. She paused in the doorway and looked around and then headed over toward me and smiled. She was in fresh jeans and another cotton shirt, but it was blue, not white. Over that was her leather jacket, and over that was a battered old raincoat that was way too big for her. Maybe it was the old guy's. Maybe she had borrowed it from him. It wasn't Elliot's, that was clear. He was smaller than she was. She must have come north, not expecting bad weather.
"Is this place safe?"
she said. I didn't answer.
"What?"
"You're buying. You got here second. I'll have another espresso. And you owe me for the first one." She looked at me blankly, and then went to the counter and came back with an espresso for me and a cappuccino for herself. Her hair was a little wet. She had combed it with her fingers. She must have parked her car on the street and walked in through the rain and checked her reflection in a store window. She counted her change in silence and dealt me bills and coins equal to the price of my first cup. Coffee was another thing way more expensive than gasoline up here in Maine, but I guessed it was the same everywhere.
"What's up?" she said.
I didn't answer.
"Reacher, what's the matter?"
"You put another agent in 8 weeks ago. Why didn't you tell me?"
"What?"
"What I said."
"What agent?"
"She died this morning. She underwent a radical double mastectomy without the benefit of anesthetic." She stared at me.
"Teresa?"
I shook my head.
"Not Teresa. The other one." "What other one?"
"Don't bullshit me."
"What other one?"
I stared at her, hard, then softer. There was something about the light in that coffee shop. Maybe it was the way it came off, all the blonde wood and the brushed metal and the glass and the chrome. It was like X-ray light, like a truth serum. It had shown me Elizabeth Beck's genuine, uncontrollable blush. Now I was expecting it to show me the exact same thing from Duffy. I was expecting it to show me a deep red blush of shame and embarrassment because I had found her out. But it showed me total surprise instead. It was right there in her face. She had gone very pale. She had gone stark white with shock. It was like the blood had drained right out of her. And nobody can do that on command any more than they can blush.
"What other one?"
she said again.
"There was only Teresa." "What? Are you telling me she's dead?"
"Not Teresa. There was another one. Another woman. She got hired on as a kitchen maid."
"No. There's only Teresa."
I shook my head again. I saw the body. It wasn't Teresa.
"A kitchen maid?"
"She had an email thing in her shoe. Exactly the same as mine. The heel was scooped out by the same guy. I recognized the handiwork."
"That's not possible."
I looked straight at her.
"I would have told you. Of course I would have told you. And I wouldn't have needed you if I had another agent in there. Don't you see that?"
I looked away, looked back. Now I was embarrassed. So who the hell was she? She didn't answer, just started nudging her cup around and around on her saucer, prodding at the handle with her forefinger, turning it 10 degrees at a time. The heavy foam and the chocolate dust stayed still while the cup rotated. She was thinking like crazy. 8 weeks ago, she said. I nodded. What alerted them? They got into your computer, I said. This morning, or maybe last night. She looked up from her cup.
That's what you were asking me about?
I nodded, said nothing.
Teresa isn't in the computer. She's off the books.
Did you check with Elliot?
I did better than check. I searched the whole of his hard drive, and all of his files on the main server back in D.C. I've got total access everywhere. I looked for Teresa, Daniel, Justice, Beck, Maine, and Undercover, and he didn't write any of those words anywhere.
I said nothing.
How did it go down?
I'm not really sure, I said. I guess at first the computer told them you had somebody in there, and then it told them it was a woman. No name, no details, so they looked for her. And I think it was partly my fault they found her.
How?
I had a stash. Your Glock and the ammo and a few other things. She found them. She hid them in the car she was using. Duffy was quiet for a second.
Okay. And you're thinking they searched the car and your stuff made her look bad, right?
I guess so.
But maybe they searched her first and found the shoe.
I looked away. I sincerely hope so.
Don't beat up on yourself. It's not your fault. As soon as they got into the computer, it was only a matter of time for the first one they looked at. They both fit the bill. I mean, how many women were there to choose from? Presumably just her and Teresa. They couldn't miss.
I nodded. There was Elizabeth, too, and there was the cook. But neither one of them would figure very high on a list of suspicious persons. Elizabeth was the guy's wife, and the cook had probably been there 20 years.
But who was she? I asked.
She played with her cup until it was back in its starting position. The unglazed rim on the bottom made a tiny grinding sound.
It's obvious, I'm afraid. Think of the timeline here. Count backward from today. 11 weeks ago, I screwed up with the surveillance photographs. 10 weeks ago, they pulled me off the case. But because Beck is a big fish, I couldn't give it up. And so 9 weeks ago, I put Teresa in without their knowledge. But also because Beck is a big fish, and without my knowledge, they must have reassigned the case to someone else. And 8 weeks ago, that someone else put this maid person in right on top of Teresa. Teresa didn't know the maid was coming, and the maid didn't know Teresa was already there.
Why would she have nosed into my stuff?
I guess she wanted to control the situation. Standard procedure. As far as she was concerned, you weren't anybody kosher. You were just a loose cannon, some kind of troublemaker. You were a cop killer, and you were hiding weapons. Maybe she thought you were from a rival operation. She was probably thinking of selling you out to Beck. It would have enhanced her credibility with him. And she needed you out of the way because she didn't need extra complications. If she didn't sell you out to Beck, she would have turned you into us as a cop killer. I'm surprised she didn't already.
Her battery was dead.
She nodded. 8 weeks. I guess kitchen maids don't have good access to cell phone chargers.
Beck said she was out of Boston.
Makes sense. They probably farmed it out to the Boston field office. That would work, geographically. And it would explain why we didn't pick up any kind of water cooler whispers in D.C.
He said she was recommended by some friends of his?
Yeah, plea bargainers for sure. We use them all the time. They set each other up quite happily. No code of silence with these people.
Then I remembered something else Beck had said. How was Teresa communicating?
She had an email thing, like yours.
In her shoe?
Duffy nodded, said nothing. I heard Beck's voice loud in my head. I'm going to start searching people's shoes, that's for damn sure. You can bet your life on that.
When did you last hear from her?
She fell off the air the second day.
Duffy went quiet. Where was she living?
In Portland. We put her in an apartment. She was an office clerk, not a kitchen maid.
You been to the apartment?
She nodded. Nobody's seen her there since the second day.
You check her closet?
Why?
We need to know what shoes she was wearing when she was captured.
Duffy went pale again. Shit, she said.
Yeah, right. What shoes were left in her closet?
The wrong ones.
Would she think to ditch the email thing?
Wouldn't help her. She'd have to ditch the shoes, too. The hole in the heel would tell the story, wouldn't it?
We need to find her.
We sure do. She was very lucky today. They went looking for a woman, and they happened to look at the maid first. We can't count on her staying that lucky much longer.
I said nothing. Very lucky for Teresa, very unlucky for the maid. Every silver lining has a cloud. Duffy sipped her coffee, grimaced slightly like the taste was off, and put the cup back down again.
But what gave her away? In the first place, that's what I want to know. I mean, she only lasted 2 days, and that was 9 whole weeks before they broke into the computer.
What background story did you give her?
The usual, for this kind of work. Unmarried, unattached, no family, no roots. Like you, except you didn't have to fake it.
I nodded slowly. A good-looking 30-year-old woman who would never be missed. A huge temptation for guys like Paulie or Angel Doll. Maybe irresistible. A fun thing to have around. And the rest of their crew might be even worse. Like Harley, for instance. He didn't strike me as much of an advertisement for the benefits of civilization. Maybe nothing gave her away. Maybe she just went missing. You know, like women do. Lots of women go missing. Young women especially. Single, unattached women. Happens all the time, thousands a year.
But you found the room they were keeping her in.
All those missing women have to be somewhere. They're only missing as far as the rest of us are concerned. They know where they are, and the men who took them know where they are.
She looked at me. You think it's like that?
Could be.
Will she be okay?
I don't know. I hope so.
Will they keep her alive?
I think they want to keep her alive. Because they don't know she's a federal agent. They think she's just a woman.
A fun thing to have around, I thought. Can you find her before they check her shoes?
They might never check them. You know, if they're seeing her in one particular light, as it were, it would be a leap to start seeing her as something else.
She looked away, went quiet. One particular light. Why don't we just say what we mean?
Because we don't want to.
She stayed quiet, 1 minute, 2. Then she looked straight back at me, a brand new thought. What about your shoes?
I shook my head. Same thing. They're getting used to me. It would be a leap to start seeing me as something else.
It's still a big risk.
I shrugged. Beck gave me a Beretta M9, I said. So I'll wait and see. If he bends down to take a look, I'll shoot him through the middle of the forehead.
But he's just a businessman, right? Basically. Would he really do bad stuff to Teresa without knowing she was a threat to his business?
I don't know.
Did he kill the maid?
I shook my head. Quinn did.
Were you a witness?
No.
So how do you know?
I looked away. I recognized the handiwork. The fourth time I ever saw Sergeant First Class Dominique Cole was a week after the night we spent in the bar. The weather was still hot. There was talk of a tropical storm blowing in from the direction of Bermuda. I had 1 million files on my desk. We had rapes, homicides, suicides, weapons thefts, assaults, and there had been a riot the night before because the refrigeration had broken down in the enlisted mess kitchens and the ice cream had turned to water. I had just gotten off the phone with a buddy at Fort Irwin in California who told me it was the same over there whenever the desert winds were blowing. Cole came in wearing shorts and a tank top shirt. She still wasn't sweating. Her skin was still dusty. She was carrying her file, which was then about 8 times as thick as when I had first given it to her.
The Sabo has got to be metal, she said. That's their final conclusion.
Is it?
They'd have preferred plastic. But I think that's just showboating.
Okay.
I'm trying to tell you they've finished with the Sabo design. They're ready to move on with the important stuff now.
You still feel all warm and fuzzy about this Garowski guy? She nodded.
It would be a tragedy to bust him. He's a nice guy and an innocent victim. And the bottom line is he's good at his job and useful to the Army.
So what do you want to do?
It's tricky. I guess what I want to do is bring him on board and get him to feed phony stuff to whoever it is who's got the hook in. That way we keep the investigation going without risking putting anything real out there.
But?
The real thing looks phony in itself. It's a very weird device. It's like a big lawn dart. It has no explosive in it.
So how does it work?
Kinetic energy, dense metals, depleted uranium, heat, all that kind of stuff. Were you a physics postgrad?
No.
Then you won't understand it. But my feeling is, if we screw with designs, the bad guy's gonna know. It'll put Gorowski at risk. Or his baby girls, or whatever.
So you wanna let the real blueprints out there?
I think we have to.
Big risk.
Your call. That's why you get the big bucks.
I'm a captain. I'd be on food stamps if I ever got time to eat.
Decision?
Got a line on the bad guy yet?
No.
Feel confident you won't let it get away?
Totally.
I smiled. Right then, she looked like the most self-possessed human being I had ever seen. Shining eyes, serious expression, hair hooked behind her ears, short khaki shorts, tiny khaki shirt, socks and parachute boots, dark, dusty skin everywhere. So go for it.
I never dance.
What?
It wasn't just you. In fact, I'd have liked to. I appreciated the invitation, but I never dance with anybody.
Why not?
Just a thing. I feel self-conscious. I'm not very coordinated.
Neither am I.
Maybe we should practice in private.
Separately?
One-on-one mentoring helps. Like with alcoholism.
Then she winked and walked out and left a very faint trace of her perfume behind her in the hot, heavy air. Duffy and I finished our coffee in silence. Mine tasted thin and cold and bitter. I had no stomach for it. My right shoe pinched. It wasn't a perfect fit, and it was starting to feel like a ball and chain. It had felt ingenious at first. Smart and cool and clever. I remembered the first time I opened the heel, 3 days ago, soon after I first arrived at the house, soon after Duke locked the door to my room.
I'm in.
It felt like a guy in a movie. Then I remembered the last time I opened it, up in Duke's bathroom an hour and a half ago. I had fired up the unit, and Duffy's message had been waiting there for me. We need to meet. Why did you want to meet? I asked her. She shook her head.
Doesn't matter now. I'm revising the mission. I'm scrapping all our objectives except getting Teresa back. Just find her and get her out of there, okay?
What about Beck?
We're not going to get Beck. I screwed up again. This maid person was a legitimate agent, and Teresa wasn't. Nor were you. And the maid died, so they're going to fire me for going off the books with Teresa and you. And they're going to abandon the case against Beck because I compromised procedure so badly they could never make it stand up in court anymore. So just get Teresa the hell out and we'll all go home.
Okay.
You'll have to forget about Quinn. Just let it go.
I said nothing.
We failed anyway. You haven't found anything useful. Not a thing, no evidence at all. It's been a complete waste of time, beginning to end.
I said nothing.
Like my career.
When are you going to tell the Justice Department?
About the maid?
I nodded.
Right away. Immediately. I'll have to, no choice. But I'll search the files first and find out who put her in there. Because I'd prefer to break the news face to face, I guess, at my own level. It'll give me a chance to apologize. Any other way, all hell will break loose before I get the opportunity. All my access codes will be canceled, and I'll be handed a cardboard box and told to clear my desk within 30 minutes.
How long have you been there?
A long time. I thought I was going to be the first woman director.
I said nothing.
I would have told you,
she said.
I promise. If I had had another agent in there, I would have told you.
I know. I'm sorry for jumping to conclusions.
It's the stress. Undercover is tough.
I nodded. It's like a hall of mirrors up there. One damn thing after another. Everything feels unreal. We left our half-finished cups on the table and headed out into the mall's interior sidewalks, and then outside into the rain. We had parked near each other. She kissed me on the